start to our parenting discussion today. Sex education is getting its first overhaul in over a decade, with schools getting new guidelines on what to teach on the facts of life. The Ministry of Education is putting a new focus on issues like consent, coercion and sexual diversity. And there's also recognition of the role pornography and social media are playing in how young people form their views about sex. So what should parents be talking about to their children when and when it comes to sex? And how do you start those conversations? Frances Bird is Family Planning's Director of Health Promotion. Good morning and welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Good morning, Catherine.
Shall we have a quick sweep over the guidelines and just get a sense of, is there much new about the way the schools are going about their sex education? And just remind us, at what age they're learning what within the curriculum?
Sure. Well, the new guidelines are guidelines for principals, boards of trustees and for teachers about how to implement sexuality education as part of the health curriculum. So what the guidelines do is to bring schools up to date with the new New Zealand curriculum. So if we go back a little bit, we had the original guidelines or previous guidelines, and then in 2007, the ERO did a review of sexuality education in schools and found that there were some significant concerns about that. Leading on from that, the new New Zealand curriculum came on board, but the old guidelines didn't match the new New Zealand curriculum. So what the Ministry of Education have done is bring together guidance with the new curriculum so that everything sort of lines up neatly and matches.
However, is there some new stuff in there when it comes to either what is taught when, or as we said, some new elements to the teaching of sex education?
The new guidelines really highlight some of the critical elements that bring people up to date with the sort of social context and the lives that people and young people are living. So while the curriculum's been around for a number of years now, and the guidelines on the actual teaching, the sorts of topics and content that needs to be covered, that hasn't changed for a number of years. But the focus on talking about things like consent, particularly following the Roastbusters scandal, thinking about that online world that young people live in, really different to their parents' lives and to the policymakers and decision makers' lives. So it just really contextualises that. And looking at the different sort of social norms that we live with now in terms of diversity and thinking about that.
All right, listeners, happy as always to take your questions or your observations. 9 to noon at radionz.co.nz. Text us to 2101. Tweet us at 9 to noon. Shall we start with those new elements about questions like coercion and consent? Because I know, Frances, we were talking in the middle of the Roastbusters furore, and you just stopped me in my tracks when you said that it's actually very common in your professional work to come across girls and young women who actually don't have a concept of consent, don't understand that when sex is initiated, you have the right to respond or to say no thanks, right? That just completely floored me. And how common is it? At what age? And how are you advising, and indeed what the schools will be advising about, trying to give young people, boys and girls, a concept of consent?
It starts from a very early age, that the basic sort of fundamental building blocks. So if we just sort of take it back a little bit and talk about sexuality education as part of the health curriculum, it covers off the ability for young people to develop skills and confidence to look after their bodies.
And it's my body, the concept of it being my body.
My body, but my body is part of a family as well, and as part of society. So health education, sexuality education is about those good building blocks about how to look after yourself, to look after others, develop empathy, emotional awareness, and then leading into all of the sorts of skills that people need for relationships, being able to communicate, negotiate, and building layer on layer. It's a sort of a spiral curriculum over the years until the point at which young people really need to know about ideas about giving and getting consent. And I think there's a mutual idea there, and there's a message for everybody. It's something that you give, but it's something that you get. And it's not just particularly boys who have to do the pushing and the getting, and needing to sort of unpack that. And I've kind of forgotten the very beginning of your question.
Well, I'm wondering if before, I was just going to say this is the new element, but I'm wondering if before we get to the concept of consent and how you, as a parent, develop that over time, where and at what age these days, and of course it's a range, and it's about reading where your child's at, right? Mm. It's about reading those signals of, yes, this, and we all know them, but the kids who are like 5 years of everybody else and telling everybody everything, and you go, what? Something's coming out of your child's mouth, and you're going, what? And then the kids who really are just like, you can tell, there's just not going on yet, right? There's just, girls are ooh yuck and boys are ooh yuck. And so, like, how are you beginning to read the signals of their growing awareness and beginning to have those first conversations about sex, what it is, how it happens, and in what circumstances?
Well, start very young. So again, that, you know, that idea about the building blocks, start with normalising ideas about bodies, particularly reproductive parts, with very young children, getting them comfortable and confident, so that from those young ages, you're getting kids who feel that they can approach parents and ask questions about what's happening. The school curriculum will lead children through to develop their understanding and their skills, and also to help them sort of develop values around all of that. That's the point of health education. But by complementing what's going on in the classroom and talking about the family's own values, for example, around things, you know, that's the way schools and families can work together. But children will ask when they're ready, and they will take on board what they're able to take on board at the time. So I use the example of a child in my family who was told the basic concepts about sperm and eggs and conception, and what she had taken from it, well, who knows, but she blurted out in the supermarket checkout line, so how exactly did the worm get into your tummy, mummy?
Yeah.
So, you know, kids will take what they need,
yeah,
you know, and you know, they'll think about it for a while and they'll layer up and progress as they develop their own ability to understand.
Is there normally a need to initiate the talk, or is it a case of they will come out with things and that's your opening to say, right, this is an opportunity to talk in a bit more detail about exactly what happens, what goes where, and those kinds of conversations? Is it more reacting to the signals that they're giving?
It's probably a combination, but, you know, we talk about grabbing that moment. Mm. So when a child asks a question, or if you see with younger children, for example, a pregnant family member, take that opportunity to talk about what do they understand by that, what do they think's going on, and just add bit by bit, layer by layer, onto their understanding around it. If you leave it for a talk, it's probably a little bit late. You know, and
but all over the internet by then.
And I urge parents to really think about what it was like for them, and what do they want for their children. You know, that discomfort, that embarrassment that is so common of so many of our generation's stories, is that what they really want for their kids? So if you start young, talking about body parts, talking about relationships, making it as normal as possible, as one of my colleagues said, it's just sex. You know, you just build up their comfort and confidence.
Yeah.
And so by the time they're needing to ask more detailed questions, they're a little bit more confident about being able to do that. And you're not freaking out as a parent.
It's true also, because I know that in the guidelines there's a big focus on sexual identity and diversity of sexualities. And again, as you say, as you meet people, I don't know, meet a same-sex couple, or, you know, that's your chance, because they'll ask obvious questions, you know, and that's the chance to have the conversation then and just naturally build the concepts of,
absolutely,
of people's differences and varieties. This business, though, of getting information from a source you'd rather they didn't, and I wonder if, we'll come back to consent in a moment, obviously the real concern, and I know this is a real concern, it's like monitoring kids' internet use is one thing, but monitoring what far-flung Eastern European, South American website they've landed on at the ripe old age of 6 or 7 is another, right? So how are you handling this? First of all, is it a case of getting your settings on your devices right so that hopefully they're not able to type a three-letter word and end up God knows where? And second, what do you do if they do and they see something that just, you know, does not fit with any concept of anything that you've been talking to them about?
Ask them what they think they've seen and what it means. So, you know, the response is going to be different at different ages. So, yes, you can do all that preparation and you can have the computer in the family room and you can, you know, do what you can. And NetSafe have got some good ideas for parents.
They do.
And I think that we've also got some ideas in a workbook called the Open and Honest Parents Workbook. And you can download our material free from our website as well, just a wee plug there. But by asking what is it that young people think they've seen, what it means, you'll get children, you know, they won't understand it and it'll just be a sort of some sort of weird, confusing thing, and they'll forget about it.
They can often show signs of trauma in the moderate sense, right?
And depending on the level of the material.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, having that conversation around this isn't, you know, this is make-believe, it's fantasy, made-up film, and it's for adults, it's not for children.
Mm.
And whereas for older, for teenagers, for example, the conversations are much more around, is that real? You know, is that reflective of the sorts of relationships? Do they look like the people who are... You know, that you know.
Do you just get straight to the point about what the pornography industry is, and particularly its more extreme ends of it? I mean, porn has been around, as I said many times, as people were scribbling on cave walls, right? But there's a sense of, and we constantly hark back to, you know, people's playboys and penthouses stashed under the bed and everything else. What is online now is, well, you know, absolutely infinite, right? And so is that a time to start really having the conversations about values, about respect, about there's a porn industry and perhaps some of what you're seeing on there are not people living particularly happy life. You could talk about sexual slavery. And again, depending on what they're seeing and depending on one's personal values, there's a whole range of ideas about this. But is it worth getting into those conversations, and at what stage?
Well, it's absolutely worth getting into them. It's so important to teach young people critical thinking skills. So that's part of what the new guidelines is urging, you know, that let's talk about these things with young people, let's teach about it. But for families, for parents, yes, have those conversations, I mean, preferably beforehand.
Yeah.
But, you know, address it, get over the discomfort. And it is, you know, it's mortifying. It's mortifying for the young person and for the parent. But it's so important to have those conversations. And, you know, most young people will get that it is fantasy. But being able to talk about that that's fantasy, and accepting that, you know, particularly young men are looking at that material because they're curious and because it's pleasurable for them, but to understand that it is fantasy and that is not real life. And, you know, if you're going to try those tricks with your new girlfriend, don't be surprised that it's not necessarily going to be welcomed with open arms.
There's a debate over whether or not, in some instances, and this comes back again to young women and having, primarily young women, I'm being incredibly sexist here, excuse me, but coming back to people having a very developed sense of their own sexuality, what they like, what they don't like, and even discussions, you know, you could go on forever, because this is the problem, because it so comes down to people's personal perspectives and views. But things like valuing yourself, things about doing things that are pleasurable for you and the right to say no to things that are not pleasurable to you, things that you feel are not respective of your dignity. I mean, they're quite highfalutin phrases to have about very practical, very important concepts.
But if you start with children when they're very young about yes and recognising yes and no feelings, and you're building on that, then, you know, young women primarily, but not necessarily just young women, will know what they're feeling okay about and what they're not, and being able to have, through good education and family support all the way through, understand that they can honour themselves and, you know, ask, expect, and, you know, and it's mutual. So it's not just, you know, one person expecting to have particular, you know, particular experiences. It's about that respectful negotiation. That stuff's hard. You know, it is hard for young people. They've got this dream about it's going to be like this. Well, and, you know, nobody's fantasy sex life has probably ever lived up, or nobody's sex life has lived up to their fantasies. That's what talking with parents and the sexuality education they get at school, hopefully it's just building that understanding for them.
How do you navigate between being supportive and not too intrusive, particularly around the time of puberty when kids might be really protective of their own privacy?
Some of that is about providing materials. You know, if you're checking in with them, you're asking them what they're learning at school, providing written materials, you know, leaving stuff around that they could pick up and read if they're not comfortable with, you know, if they're showing they're not comfortable with talking to you. So just being as approachable as you can be, letting them know you're happy to talk about it, or if you're not, then Uncle so-and-so or another trusted adult who has a good relationship with that young person, that they can have that conversation. And certainly in some families and in some cultures within New Zealand, it's the aunt's role or the grandmother's role to have those kinds of conversations. It's not the parent's role.
It's interesting. Kids can be a bit grossed out by the idea of contemplating their parents as sexual beings, of course. But on the other hand, you've got to read signals carefully, because if there's one thing that constantly comes through, including in contemporary research, is how much, even though they send a signal that says, back off, I don't want to talk to you, I don't respect you, how much kids actually crave the wisdom and the guidance and the boundaries of their parents. So you've got to become quite a sophisticated interpreter of what's happening.
Sure, sure. And it's the parents' role to really talk about those values and the family values and hopes and dreams for their young person.
The question of consent, then, which we've touched on a couple of times, do you have a particular way that you approach this with young people? As I said, you started right back at the beginning with the idea that the body is your own, but when we are seriously coming down to the sorts of matters that were being talked about around Roastbusters, how do you approach it? I mean, that event, if it was nothing else, was a wake-up call and a conversation right around the country in some ways. So, again, how are you, without wanting to invade, reading signals, reading things that might be concerning you, and having that conversation?
We've developed, in recent months, in response to all of the noise about consent, we've developed a new teaching toolkit that helps teachers to actually use some activities to get young people thinking about consent. And the sorts of approaches are really developing young people's ability to read body language. So working out what yes might look like, what it sounds like, what it feels like, versus what no might be displayed as. So often silence means no, or, you know, rigid hard bodies means no. And just being able to read that so that young people have got some ideas and some tools. But, you know, I hesitate to say never, but that very hard edge is going to be there and it's going to exist. What we can do through sexuality education and through conversation is to get most of young people to a point where they're thinking and they're aware and they've got, you know, they know that they can say yes and no, that it's their right, and this is how you go about negotiating activity. It's not necessarily sex, it could be anything, you know, going to the movies or, you know, whatever young people do these days when they're going out. And just, you know, building those sort of skills for them. There will always be that hard edge of, you know, young people, adults who are sexual abusers, who are violent, and mainstream education's not going to fix that. That's a different kettle of fish.
A big focus in the new guidelines on sexual identity and, as we said, also sexual diversity, and how, again, are you approaching these conversations with your child at various ages and stages?
Well, you've given the suggestion already of, you know, observing, you know, everybody seems to have a gay uncle or somebody in the wider communities in the same-sex relationship, or, you know, a media report or a couple kissing on TV or something, grabbing that moment, talking about that. But, you know, we live in a world that is different, where it is far more open to have displays of affection between same-sex attracted partners. We know that 1 in 2,000 people are intersex, so we're not in a binary either-or world in terms of gender, in terms of bodies even.
You know, Caitlyn Jenner is a big talking point at the
moment. Yeah, and you know, grabbing that moment as a parent, you know, there's an opportunity to talk about, well, what do we mean by gender and what makes a man and a woman, or you know, just sort of teasing out some of those ideas, taking that conversation.
Homophobic bullying, I think there's work being done that often suggests one of the motivations for homophobic bullying is a young person not coming to terms with their own sexuality, and in order to sort of put up the wall of don't suspect me, is getting stuck into someone else. This is really worth talking about, isn't it? The whole area of mental health and of looking after people. What sort of stage are you beginning to have those conversations again early on, right? And then
it's part of respecting difference. Mm. So having that conversation about, you know, caring for other people. It doesn't matter who they are or what they are in terms of the difference from you and your family. So there's a huge range of diversity, whether it's cultural, ethnic. It could be around, for example, sexual orientation, or it might be to do with gender identity.
This is a question I want to put to you because I think it is something that is going to emerge. In fact, there's a very famous professor in the United States. We're trying to get to talk about some of his concerns about this matter at the moment, and it is the extent to which online exposure, the pervasiveness of online exposure, might actually be not just part of a healthy sex life, but might actually, in the case of young men, he's focusing on beginning to affect their relationships and forming relationships with young women, right? Yep. This emailer says, my son is a very physically mature 12-year-old with a distinct mismatch between mental and physical maturity. We've found him on porn sites a couple of times and are particularly disturbed as he's not had sex education. We think exposure to sex via porn sites is an unhealthy introduction to it. We explained this to him but caught him again. This time he was tearful and said, "I don't know why I do it. I can't help it." We don't really want to block these sites as we prefer to depend on trust in our household. Do you have any suggestions about how to deal with this? The "I can't help it" rings alarm bells with me. Does it with you?
Well, I think it's a pretty normal, in inverted commas, thing for a young man who is reaching sexual maturity to be doing. We know that international research shows that an awful lot of young people, particularly young males, are exposed to and seeking out sexually explicit material. So it's not an unusual thing. And if his body is full of hormones and he's interested, then that's not wildly unusual. If he was seeking out that and then interfering with the neighbour's children, then yes, that's absolutely concerning. But if it's something that is age and stage appropriate for him, that he's observing it and perhaps he's pleasuring himself while he's doing it, we haven't talked about that at all.
This whole who's having the conversation about masturbation and again at what stage, and are you talking about quite early on, you know, nice feelings or tingly feelings or whatever, and that stuff is okay? How are those conversations had?
Well, we're sensual beings, so from a very early age, you know, babies love to be petted and tickled, and not always tickled, but you know, building on that idea that when people are sexually maturing, then they'll learn that there's a different pleasure to touching parts of their bodies.
They'll learn it with or without you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not a sexual thing when they're little, and
no.
I think people get a bit afraid about it.
They're good. They're very good explorers of their bodies, young children. But it's more that stage when it is becoming a pleasurable activity, but you are wanting to avoid getting into that sort of shame or sort of sense about it. You know?
So it's that thing about public and private body parts, public and private places, and generally, you know, you've done that kind of work by the time they're three or four. That's when they're starting to ask questions in public, or they're starting to touch themselves in ways that you think, you know, it's okay in our house, but grandma might be a little bit uncomfortable about it if you start doing that in her lounge. So, you know, having those
probably
conversations...
Probably not in the lounge anywhere.
Not in anyone's lounge.
We should complete for that earlier email. I mean, what you're saying is, I suppose, it's hard to interpret from this young lad's words, "I don't know why I do it, I can't help it." I mean, if it's occasional, right, and it's probably linked to occasional pleasure, that's a different matter than if it's, you know, every time he's going into his room all day, all night.
Yeah.
Although
that
you can debate it, you know. Mm. So, again, it's being that sophisticated interpreter of what is going on.
Mm.
Yeah. You mentioned the idea of, if there's interfering going on with the neighbour or anyone else, and it's a sort of a taboo subject in some ways, isn't it? But I think everyone is familiar with, you know, you show me yours, I'll show you mine. But if there is something that you are aware of that is inappropriate, right, and involving someone else, how are you, A, not going to panic, and B, going to deal with it?
The best thing would be to talk to somebody else to find out what, you know, if you're not sure what is considered normal behaviour, then have a conversation with someone else as quickly as possible. So, you know, if you're a first-time parent and or it's your oldest child, or it's the first time you've seen a child display that kind of behaviour compared to your other children, then have a conversation with somebody, you know, get in touch and hope. There's good agencies around. You know, I wouldn't fly into an enormous panic.
It's the difference between an exploration and something that is becoming a sexual activity at an age where,
and particularly when other people are concerned. If it's if there's an abuse involved, a use of power over a younger child, dominating, violence, anything like that, then yes, that's deeply concerning.
It's all instinctive, as you say, but it's interesting that point you do make, which is to talk to others. And it's strange because is it an area, particularly with things that are concerning parents, where they're loath to do that, worried about judgment or worried about the kid being carted off? You know, it's a tricky one, but it's important, as it is with every other area of parenting, isn't it? Just to talk and get some reassurance.
Yeah. Close friends and family, anyone who's been there before that you feel safe with having that conversation with, for sure.
Frances, thanks very much. Frances Bird, Family Planning's Director of Health Promotion.